So I want to start off by asking all of you several questions. In your travels within Montana, as well as traveling out of Montana and back into Montana, first, how many of you have made those trips by airplane? Raise your hand. Okay, I'd say really close to almost all. How many of you have done it by bus? Greyhound, Rimrock, Jefferson Lines? Okay, ooh. single digits. How many of you have traveled in or out of or within Montana by passenger train? Okay, that's maybe it looks like a third to a quarter. And how many of you, when you think about doing a trip, especially a fairly major trip, and I'm talking not about the destination, but you're thinking about the actual travel, how many of you look forward to traveling by public transport these days? Okay. I don't even see one hand. We'll come back to this. And one of my theses is that there's a relatively short time, probably in the middle of the 20th century, when Americans, and I assume beyond the United States, actually looked forward to getting on an airplane, a train, a ship, and maybe even intercity bus. But we'll come back to that. 110 years ago, you could get from, you could start in any place, almost any place in Montana, hundreds of places, and from there you could get by public transportation to another place, perhaps equally remote. You could get from Freud, Montana, way up in the northeast, to Lima, down in the southwest near the Idaho border. Now, it would take a while. There'd be some transfers and layovers, but you could do it without owning your own vehicle. And it's been a long time since one could do that. And what we're looking at today is the rise of public transportation, its peak, and then its long decline. And so I want to start with a local train, a train that traveled on Great Northern's main line between Williston, North Dakota, and Havre, Montana. It's now the main line of the BNSF Railway. But in 100 years ago, on that main line, there were several mainline trains, Chicago, St. Paul, Seattle trains. And they passed through many of the towns between the North Dakota border and Havre without stopping. So the Great Northern ran a local train, trains left Havre and Williston in the morning and spent most of their traveling one west and one east until they reached their destination. And they stopped up to 61 times during that trip. This was a trip that was 309 miles long, and it took, if the train was on time, it took between an 11 and a half and 12 hours. And they didn't stop. There were 61 places, towns, small cities, settlements. Some of them were just a telegraph station along the railway or a base where the track workers lived in a small, little, tiny community. And at some of the stops at towns, that there was a scheduled stop, but many of those stopping places were optional. They were called flag stops, and the way and they stopped only if there was a passenger who wanted to get on or off. If you were on the train and you wanted to get off, you went to the conductor or brakeman and told them, and they would signal the engineer with a communication cord to the locomotive that the train was stopped. If you wanted to get on the train, and this is long before, obviously, before reservations over telephone or computer, you actually stood by the track, if there was a station or a platform, and as soon as you saw the locomotive come in sight, you made your presence clear. And the train would stop. This was a train, and the locals called this train the Skidoo. It's spelled like the snowmobile Skidoo, only pronounced Skidoo. The westbound trains had numbers. All trains had numbers. The westbound train was number originally it was 23, and then it became 223. 100 years ago, there was a phrase called 23 Skidoo. And it meant to leave quickly. And often it meant to leave in a hurry or leave trouble. Now, on the skidoo that ran in on the Great Northern, you did not leave quickly. But the train number 23, someone matched that with the phrase 23 skidoo. And so the local people called it the skidoo. That name did not show up in the timetable or in any of the Great Northern literature. The same crew ran that, if not every day, most of each week. And they got to know the local passengers who would use it to go to the county seat, to go shopping in a market town, to visit family, whether it was a 5-mile trip or a 155-mile trip. And this was also on a section of line that if you've probably noticed, especially if you've traveled up there, this was a section of the line that had all those foreign place names at a greater density. And there's no clear explanation of how they got them. But if you rode the train its entire length, you'd go through places, and I'm going to try to pronounce them in their European pronunciation, but they were sometimes these pronunciations would be adapted and anglicized. Calais, Chelsea, Glasgow, Paisley, Tampico, Cork, Malta, Exeter, Coburg, Savoy, Madras, Zurich, and Havre. And there's several stories about how all those names got attached to the place, but the explanations I don't think are correct, and so we don't know. But it would take you through all those, and of those stops I named, only the main trains only stopped at three of those, at Glasgow, Malta, and Havre. And all the other places, if you wanted to get into that place or out of it by train, you had to ride the skidoo. And here's how, at least for one person in Coburg. This is from a contribution to a web blog by someone named Eva, and writing about the Second World War when there was rationing of gasoline to save tires. And so the trains during the Second World War saw more traffic than they had in the 1930s. At age 12, my sister became too old to ride the train for half fare. So being 3 years younger, I stepped into her job of going 11 miles from Coburg to Dodson. We're talking about west of Malta here. For the mail and any grocery items that my parents might need. After walking northwest about a mile from our farm home to the Milk River, I stood on the wooden platform of the Great Northern Railway Depot at the nearly deserted town of Coburg. On this day, when I was 9 years old, I knelt by the railroad track and put my ear to the rail. The distant sound of the steam locomotive echoed down the track. When I saw the locomotive emerge from around the bend to the west, I stood in the middle of the track and waving my arms up and down until the toot-toot assured me that I had been seen. As the steam locomotive pulling two cars came to a grinding stop, the conductor stepped down and placed a stool for me. As I stepped up, he gave his usual greeting, "How in the world are you?" and helped me into the train car. Holding out his hand, he took my 11 cents, a penny a mile, and I was off to Dodson. Getting off, and she had about two hours if the train was on time. Getting off in Dodson Depot only minutes later, I crossed the railroad track and went south a block to the post office for the mail. I had 2 hours to make my purchases and even window shop at each of the three grocery and general merchandise stores in town before buying my homeward bound ticket for Mrs. Swetch, the depot agent. Getting aboard, I asked the conductor to let me off at the crossing west of the Coburg Depot so I could walk across our alfalfa field to our farmhouse and save a little walking time. He contacted the engineer, and they obligingly stopped. Now, there's personalized transportation. You know, this is long before Uber came around. But riding those trains, and many of the people who rode trains back 100 years ago, whether it was in Montana or in upstate Maine or down in the Texas Panhandle, they did not ride the storied expresses with the dining cars and linen. They rode these local trains, 2, 3, 4 cars long, day coaches, red plush seating that apparently when it was really hot was really itchy, probably the floors stained with tobacco spit. Although most trains had a smoker, which was a section of a railway car or a whole car, and that was where the men could smoke their cigars. That was where the traveling salesmen could tell their farmers' daughters jokes and tell, you know, which is the best hotel in Haver and more. But these were not trains that were fun to ride. So this is from a novel by Sinclair Lewis, Elmer Gantry. And Sinclair Lewis grew up on the prairies of Montana at Sauk Center. He calls it Gopher Prairie in Main Street. And I expect this description is from his experience riding the Great Northern Railway west out of Minneapolis-St. Paul. And this is set in Kansas, but it could be in almost anywhere. They were on the 516 for Cato. The train consisted of a day coach, a combined smoker and baggage car, and a rusty old engine and tender. The train so on the rough tracks as it bumped through the drooping light that Elmer and Jim were thrown against each other and gripped the arm of their seat. The car staggered like a freighter in a gale. The tall, raw farmers perpetually shuffling forward to a drink at the water cooler stumbled against them or seized Jim's shoulder to steady themselves. To every surface in the old smoking car, to streaked windows in rusty ironworks and mud-smeared coconut matting, clung a sickening bitterness of cheap tobacco fumes, and whenever they touched the red plush of the seat, dust whisked up and the prints of their hands remained on the plush. The car was jammed. People came to sit on the arm of their seat to shout at their friends across the aisle. Not a lot of glamour there. So I want to briefly just talk about public transportation, a quick definition and some of the aspects of it. In the history of human transportation, which goes back thousands of years, the idea of public transportation is relatively new, a few hundred years old. And so it's a small part, and as I'll say later on, I think it, in many parts of the world, and including Montana, it's fading. It's going away. It can be divided into intercity transportation and urban transportation. But what by public transportation, at least what I mean by it, is transportation that is open to the public. It's not operated for the employees of a certain company, for instance, or a certain group of people. It's if you're willing to abide by the circumstances, you can ride it and pay a fare. It usually includes fixed routes. Well-known fixed schedules, published schedules, and fares that often are published as well, or you can find out ahead of time what the fare is. And so if you're willing to abide by their schedule and you have the money, you can ride. Now, in various situations, in areas where there is segregation, there might be limitations on that. And public transportation is, as I'll come back to later, is very expensive to operate. And so often public transportation came with the carriage of priority goods, the mail, for instance, whether it's U.S. mail or the Royal Mail or other national mail systems. That express was often combined with that, sometimes even perishables, money, and more. The name of the full name of the Titanic was RMS Titanic, Royal Mail Steamer Titanic. And without that mail contract, the Lusitania, the Mauritania, and the Titanic perhaps could not have operated. So governments, public transportation has often been regulated by the government for the safety and comfort of passengers and workers, as well as sometimes subsidized through mail contracts, for instance, or express. Government express or carrying government goods. Initially, public transportation was privately owned and operated. Stagecoach lines, city omnibus lines, railways, steamship lines, airlines were privately owned and operated. Again, sometimes with government regulation or subsidies. But in the 20th century, as especially for land transportation, as automobiles became more common, along with improved public roads, there was more competition to public transportation, railways, and so often these operation started to lose money. And for many of the surviving public transportation, air transport aside, is now largely government-owned, whether that's urban transit systems or whether it's the rail passenger systems in the United States and Canada, where we have Amtrak and Canada has VIA. They are government-owned, and they lose money. There's a saying in the railroad business anyway that any enterprise that is dedicated to carrying passengers is a money loser, unless you can get a great mail contract or a subsidy or something like that. Probably the first public transport goes back thousands of years, and that was people who operated ferries across rivers, where the public needed to cross from one side of a major travel route from one side of the river to another. But in terms of wheeled transportation, it goes back to the 1600s in Europe with stagecoaches, mail coaches, omnibuses, horse-pulled carriages, whether it was for urban transport or intercity transport in places like France and England. And so that's just a quick background on public transportation. And my thesis is public transportation is a recent phenomenon in the history of human travel and passenger travel, and that it reached its peak in Montana, throughout much of the rural United States, and I would guess even throughout the world in the early 20th century, at the height of railroad network and passenger transportation over that. And since the 1920s in the U.S., in Canada, in Montana, public transportation has been diminishing. Now, if you live in a place like Seattle or the Seattle-Portland corridor, that may not be evidence. But if you live in Lewistown, Montana, which has no public transportation, it's all too evident. And I'll come back to some of the reasons for that. But there are parts of Montana now, the public transportation, trying to get a scheduled ride in or out of towns, especially in central and eastern Montana, you had an easier time in 1883 than you do now in getting a ride. And it's the chance of it improving is nil. And so that's much of what follows is going to be in that. In the time period between 1910 and 1920, railroads in the United States and Canada provided a wider range of services, transportation and associated communication service, than any single mode of transportation before or since. And so that would include horse-pulled transportation before, it include automobiles and trucks since then. And if you looked at the range of transportation and communications that railroads did in 1915, for instance, and now look at the range of modes of transportation that do the same services that was all combined into railroads, you would be looking at private automobiles, you'd be looking at trucks, both privately owned and commercially operated. You'd be looking at buses, both intercity and commuter buses. You'd be looking at airplanes for long-distance travel. You'd be looking at the trucks that are parked and stopped in front of your house, that UPS truck or that FedEx truck. 100 years ago, that would have been a horse-pulled carriage or perhaps an early a truck with Railway Express Agency written across the door. And so what railroads provided then in the range of services, in the extent of the number of communities they reached, is now done by a whole variety of commercial and private vehicles and enterprises. And railroads in Montana in 1915 reached more places, hundreds of places, than were reached before then by steamboats or stagecoaches and have been reached since then. Now, there was great service, but as covered, it wasn't always comfortable in that sense. So just how many places in Montana were reached by railroads where the trains stopped? It's hundreds, and I did not look at 42 timetables and count every stop on those timetables. But here's some clues. In 1920, in the 1920 report in the 1920 census by the U.S. government, there were 107 formally incorporated by under state law, towns and cities in Montana. That ranged from all the big ones like Great Butte and Great Falls down to the smallest of these was Hingham, west of Havre on the High Line on US 2 on the Great Northern. Of those 107 towns, 105 had railway service with passenger trains. There were only two towns on that list that did not have railways, and they never did. One was Ekalaka, one, of course, in far eastern Montana, and the other was Virginia City, which never actually had a railroad. But 98 to 99% of those towns, and those railroads also served hundreds of other communities that weren't in unincorporated towns like Logan, Ringling, Salesville, present-day Gallatin Gateway, Trident, Tostin, Willow Creek. So hundreds of those small towns, community settlements were served, as well as hundreds of railway stops, isolated telegraph stations away from population centers. Those telegraphers needed a way to get to and from their job when they had a break or a vacation. And hundreds of section bases where the track workers, often immigrants, lived in a little community by the track side. And so that those 61 stops that the Skidoo had between Williston and Havre, some of those were full-fledged towns like Wolf Point or Malta, some were smaller communities, some was just a telegraph station, a water tank, and a track workers base. So how many towns in Montana now have regular scheduled public transport? 42. 13 sit towns are served by air, and over half of those are government-subsidized flights, and I'll come back to that in a bit, the essential air service towns. Amtrak serves 11 towns in northern Montana, three of which also have air service. And then there's 21 towns in Montana that have bus service. And basically, those are out in western Montana. There's between Whitefish and Missoula and from Great Falls south through Helena Butte down to the Idaho border. Not surprisingly, the central and eastern part of Montana there's only 9 towns in that 3/5 of Montana that have public transportation on the High Line and on the I-94 route. And so that's what Montana has lost. And I would assume for most states east of the Cascades and Sierra Nevadas until you start to hit the Mississippi River, it would be similar stories for those states. So if raise your hand when asked about airplanes. You know about airplanes and air travel. You know about airports because you have to. And if you look out there and you see a twin-engine turboprop waiting for your plane, as the planes to Seattle used to be until very recently, you know that there's a certain kind of ride ahead of you. Cascade's actually going to give you a free beer. Not Cascade, but Horizon's going to give you a free beer. They've switched to jets now, and they don't give free beer anymore. But you know about airlines. You know about it because you have to. And people used to, when people went to a train station 100 years ago, they knew the same equivalent kind of thing about trains. They knew if they were going to Spokane, they'd be on a certain kind of train as opposed to going to Logan for a quick turnaround. And so I want to just quickly run over the types of trains that people rode and the ones that get a lot of attention, starting with those, and the ones that don't get attention. And again, I'll start off by saying each pair of trains is numbered. Generally, the premier pair of trains on any railroad was numbered 1 and 2. One would be westbound, 2 would be eastbound. And on the premier trains, they had names as well, officially assigned names that showed up in the timetable. And some of the great trains that ran through Montana, especially on the east-west routes, were trains like the Oriental Limited and the Empire Builder up on the Great Northern Line, the High Line, and Amtrak still calls their train the Empire Builder, the Glacier Park Limited. On the Northern Pacific Line that ran through Bozeman through Billings, Bozeman, and Missoula. There was the North Coast Limited for 71 years. You could go down to the station on Front Street in northeast Bozeman and get on one of the best trains in the country in terms of service, in terms of equipment, and reputation from 1900 until Amtrak came into existence in 1971. On the Milwaukee line through more the central portion of the state on an east-west route, you had the Olympian Hiawatha, the Columbian. And if you wanted to head south out of Butte, you took the Butte Special to Pocatello, Ogden, and Salt Lake City. These trains were a full-length train, 10, 12 cars long, would be as long as an ocean liner. And it would have almost all the services of an ocean liner, except it had to fit in cars that were 10 feet wide. So it was much more compact than the Queen Mary or the Mauritania. And so I just want to run through what was on that train. Stopped, headed west out of Bozeman, the North Coast Limited or the Pacific Express or the Northern Pacific. You have a steam locomotive, we're talking about, say, 1920, steam locomotive at the front. The cars right behind the steam locomotive were called head-end cars. These were the non-passenger cars. They would carry, that's where the baggage would be carried. That's where the express, the Railway Express Agency or the Northern Pacific Express was carried, and the U.S. mail. In fact, there was actually a post office in one of those cars, a railway post office. It had all the fittings of a post office, all those pigeonholes for sorting letters and mail. They could cancel mail. They could sell stamps during stops. They picked up and dropped off mail, both when the train was stopped at stops, and they picked up and dropped it off when the train was moving. If you were in a town like Belgrade, when it was a small town and the North Coast Limited went through it 40 miles an hour. There was a steel crane outside, next to the track, a big steel crane with arms. The postal employee would bring a canvas bag with loops on each end. They'd put it over the ends of these extended arms, and then when the train came through, a steel arm came out from the side of the train, snagged that canvas bag, and pulled it in. And that's how the westbound mail would leave Belgrade. And at the same time, out another door, a postal employee would kick off a canvas bag with the outgoing mail. And thousands of communities throughout the United States, small towns where the expresses did not stop. That's how 2, 4, 6 times a day the mail would leave town. And so that railway post office car, when it was stopped in Bozeman, if you wanted to get something out on time, right on time, you could go up to the station on the northeast part of town, and on the side of the car was a little letter slot. You'd pull a little cover down. You'd drop your letter inside, put it up. They would cancel it. They'd sort it. You know, was it going to head towards Portland? Was it going to head towards Spokane? And they would cancel it with a special cancellation. And you would know in 10 minutes your mail was on its way, and it'd probably get to Spokane faster in 1915 than it does now. Because now that mail is, you drop it in the mailbox or at the slot in the downtown, it is flown to Billings, and it goes through an automatic optical sorter there and then is put on another airplane and flown west. And so mail moved fast in many, especially along main lines. Mail moved faster 100 years ago than it does now. So those were these were the premier trains. And you had the head-end cars, and then you had coaches followed that. Day coaches that were for short passengers making short trips. Ultimately, there'd be coaches with leg rests for people who were overnight. The middle part of the train would have the food service. There'd be a dining car, maybe a lounge car as well. And then you'd have the sleeping cars at the back. In 100 years ago, there would have been both compartment sleeping cars, little rooms, roomettes, but there were also berths that folded down, and you'd sleep on a berth with a heavy brown curtain, a heavy fabric curtain holding you in, and you had to climb up a little. For the upper berth, you climbed up a little ladder to get there. And then on the back of the premier trains would be the observation car with an open platform, and you've probably seen pictures of politicians speaking with that brass railing, you know, Teddy Roosevelt leaning over, and that was on the back end of a lot of trains. And you could sit back there on a warm day and watch the track recede behind you. So those were the premier trains. These are the ones that there's picture books written about them. They get featured probably in films and reminiscence backward. And some of them even required an extra fare. But most people did not ride them. They rode the secondary train on that route. It was a little slower. It didn't have quite the amenities. They rode secondary routes, Billings to Omaha. These were trains that were shorter. And, for instance, an example would be from Billings to Denver, run by the Burlington route. And this was a train that had a short-lived name, the Shoshone. But in the 1950s, it had a different name. It crossed through southern Wyoming at night, both the north and southbound trains, and it was called the Nightcrawler. And that was at least the name of the train. And again, it was never showed up in timetables, but that was what local people called it. And that's mostly what a lot of people rode. Not the premier trains, but... And then finally you had the locals, like the Skidoo, that stopped or could stop, depending on demand, every 5 miles or so as they averaged 20 miles an hour throughout much of the day. And these often did have other names. There was one in eastern Washington called the locals called it the Sage Hen. So I want to give an example of a trip that one person could take. This is I took someone who actually lived in Bozeman, and a woman named Edith Luther, who graduated with a degree in chemistry from Montana State College in 1917 at the age of 31, a non-traditional student. She was from Shoto, where her family lived. She lived in a house on 409 South Grand, just north of what people now call the Julia Martin House. It was a boarding house. She was a roomer at the boarding house. And so what we're going to do is we're going to follow her on how she would have gotten from that house to her parents in Shoto, the range of transportation services. If you go to that, the house is still there, and it's actually there's a sign in front. It's got six units in it. It's not a rooming house per se, but an apartment house, literally, in that sense. If you go stand out in front of South Grand Avenue, the pavement in front of that house, and you look in the center of the pavement, it's got corrugated pavement. That is because the cross ties of the Bozeman Street Railway, the electric railway, are still under that pavement. The rail was pulled up in 1922 when the railway was abandoned. The ties are still there, and the pavement has slowly settled between the ties. And you can actually see where they had to cut the pavement to pull out the rails and then repave, but you can still see the lines. It's especially effective if it's just rained and there's little parallel puddles between in this corrugation. So she could, she could have left her rooming house at 409 South Grand and literally stopped, flagged down a streetcar. Now the train she's taking leaves Bozeman at 5:20 in the morning. So I'm not actually sure that the streetcars ran that early. But for a more central daytime, a departure time, she could have literally walked 40 feet, hailed a streetcar that would run her through downtown out to the train station that still stands, boarded up on North Front Street. So there was a train that, this is in 1916-17, that left Bozeman at 5:20, and it was one of these mainline passenger trains, St. Paul to Seattle Tacoma, and it would take 3 hours and 25 minutes to do the 98 miles to Helena. And then she'd have 2 hours, 15 minutes in Helena. She'd have to go from the NP station on the east side of Helena to the Great Northern station on the north edge, but there was a streetcar line. And so she could take that, but she could create, there was a lunchroom in the NP station. She could maybe get a quick lunch in the NP station before going to the GN station. and then getting on a train that would take her from Helena to Great Falls, 3 hours and 20 minutes for 99 miles. This would take her through the Prickly Pear Canyon that you, if you take I-15 north, you go through. And if you may have noticed, there's a railway line there. It's out of use now, but that's the line she would have taken. That would have taken her to Great Falls, to the Great Northern Station there. She'd have a short layover. She could go out and maybe go around and look at the octagonal tower that rises high above the roof of the Great Northern Station. And then get on a mixed train that would carry her from Great Falls to Shoto, 59 miles. And that 59 miles would take 3 hours. This mixed train was basically a freight train with a passenger car, a combination baggage express coach at the back end of the, and it would stop. It would not only drop off passengers and express, but it might shift cars at a grain elevator, drop a carload of lumber at a coal yard, and do that business. It would be the only, except during harvest season, it was probably the only train, the only pair of trains that ran on that line. And she would get in, if everything ran on time, she would get into Shoto at 6 o'clock in the evening. This was a trip of about 285 miles that took her 12 hours and 40 minutes. I don't know how much it cost. The timetables don't list fares, but it cost less than 3 cents a mile because in 1905, the Montana state government, which could regulate intrastate traffic, passed a law saying that the railroads could not charge more than 3 cents a mile for their basic coach ticket. So if they charged 3 cents a mile, it would be about $7.50. But she had an extra advantage as a Montana State College student. In 1917, the Montana State Legislature passed a bill that said anyone who was enrolled in the Montana public system of higher education, which would include Missoula, Bozeman, Dillon, and Butte, they could, once a year, if their train trip home cost more than a round trip, cost more than $5, the state would refund them for that trip. So the state would pay for one trip home. So that is an example of public transportation. Slow, perhaps. Maybe not all that comfortable. Air conditioning was opening the window a little bit farther, and that would bring in more soot and cinders, depended on what kind of coal the locomotive was burning and how good the fireman was. But if it was casting out a lot of things, then it could be by the end you could feel really sooty on the ride. Passenger transportation, public transportation, is very expensive to operate. It involves vehicles, airplanes, ships, boats, trains, buses that are expensive to acquire, and because they move, they require a tentative maintenance if you're going to keep them operating in good order. If you're a railroad or a canal in the early stages, you have to build the right-of-way for your transport. If you're a bus company or an airline, the bus companies can use public roads, the airlines use open skies. But if you're a railroad, you have to build, maintain, and pay property taxes on that rail line, which may have a right-of-way anywhere from 75 to 400 feet wide. You need terminals. You need huge urban terminals, whether it's a grand train station or an airport or a seaside a docking area for the steamship. And then for railroads, you need dozens of intermediate stations where people can buy tickets, can check their luggage, can pick up their luggage. And it's very labor intensive. You need people to operate the vehicles. You need people to maintain them, to maintain the right of way. You need clerks. And if you're serving meals on board your vehicle or you're offering sleeping accommodations, you need porters and laundry. You need to run a laundry establishments, you need to have commissaries for the dining car. And when railroads had little competition before automobiles and improved public roads came along, they could make money on passenger trains with those mail cars up in front. But once the automobiles came on, the tremendous investment that public transport required in fixed properties and moving properties and labor meant that they almost inevitably lost money, even with the express and mail. And by the mid 20th century, railroads, many of the railroads wanted out of the passenger business. For one thing, you can ship a crate of something in a boxcar and it won't complain. If it's running late, if it's hot, you know, this sort of thing. But if a passenger is hot and running late, they're going to complain. They're going to complain to the crew. They're going to write a letter to the head office. And so railroads in the 50s and 60s and started thinking, you know, this passenger business is a real hassle, especially away from the main lines. And so they started trying to get out of it. It meant that initially until 1962, they had to go to the states and get permission to abandon service. They had to prove that there were alternates available, buses, or there, you know, that hardly, you know, they could show low ridership numbers and more. And but before that happened, and this goes back to that question I asked you, I think there was a decade and a half in the 1960s plus or minus that was the golden age of travel. That's when, and I think probably many of you probably remember this. I remember it as a kid, looking forward to a family trip, getting on a train with a dining car and a dome car, getting on an airplane when airplanes were 707s were really exciting, even a 747. It was exciting, you know. Before deregulation, carriers had to compete on service. They couldn't compete on price because that was regulated. So they had to compete on service, friendliness of the workers, and food and more. I think one of the things that killed the fun of traveling was deregulation. When the prices dropped and people said, I don't care what the food is like, I just want a cheap ride. And so I think that and other factors did a lot to take the fun out of travel. But there were other factors as well, of course. And one of them was, of course, the automobile. Or as one of the salesmen in the opening of A Music's Man said when they're talking about how this set in 1912, how their trade of being a traveling salesman is changing. And one of them says, it's a Model T Ford that made the trouble, made the people want to get up and go 10, 12, 14, 22, 23 miles to the county seat. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And and people, the automobile has, still does, advantages that the train could never meet. With an automobile, you can go when you want to. You can take that stop when you want to. You can take a side trip. You don't have to wonder who's going to be sitting next to you. And you don't have to pack very carefully. You can just throw stuff in the back seat. And you don't have to worry about, is this going to fit in the overhead thing? And so automobiles, and that's often credited, but I think without massive government spending on roads, country roads, crowned gravel roads to interstates, without that, the car would not have had the appeal. And so as the combination of the automobile, increasingly reliable tires that could go for months without a flat tire, that was a wonder. I remember talking to some people from the South. They said, you know what made cars popular in the South and took people away from passenger trains? When they put air conditioning in cars. And if you had to go from Cincinnati to New Orleans in the summer and without air conditioning in your car, you might take the Louisville and Nashville Hummingbird instead. But once you could get that Pontiac with air conditioning, you were good. And so as public transportation options faded, offerings faded, governments had various responses. So when airlines were deregulated in the Carter administration, late 70s. And the government, U.S. government, knew that once the airlines were relieved of many of their obligations that came with regulation, they would stop serving the smaller cities. Why run planes to Havre when you could put that on a Southern California route? So the government created the Essential Air Service, which funneled money to airlines, and now that just serve. So Montana has 7 of these towns: Havre, Glasgow, Wolf Point, Sydney, Glendive, West Yellowstone in the summer, and even Butte, that only have air service because the government stepped in, realizing that it would take government subsidies. And these subsidies run to $2 million a year for each of those places. It stopped running to Lewistown a couple years ago because the average subsidy for every passenger that got on or off a plane in Lewistown was over $2,000. And so, but anyway, the U.S. government recognized we need to preserve this network of air travel for people. When the passenger trains were fading, the freight railroads wanted to get rid of them in the United States and Canada, the government in both those countries created systems to take up preserve much of the network. Amtrak in the United States in 1971, and then 6 years later, VIA for Canada. And they both still exist. They've shrunk since their creation. By the 1970s, for thousands of towns around the United States, dozens of towns in Montana, the last existing transportation was the intercity bus, Greyhound or Trailways. And starting in 2004, Greyhound started skipping stops, not stopping in Big Timber and Drummond anymore, just stopping in the larger cities. And now Greyhound's gone from the state. There are replacement lines, but they're less stable. There have been several transfers. Greyhound Canada, a year and a half ago, announced that they had an extensive network through the prairie provinces of Canada up into the North Country, the forested areas. They announced in October 2018 they were going to end all bus service in 3 provinces, Saskatchewan, Alberta, and Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta, and parts of BC. Hundreds of towns lost their last public transportation. And just an odd connection, the school buses that you see on Bozeman that say First Student on the side, they are owned by the same company that runs Greyhound US in Canada. It's based in Aberdeen, Scotland. It's called First Group. So when you see that First Student bus, the head office for that bus is in Aberdeen. And you can imagine that the managers in Aberdeen probably aren't all that concerned about whether towns in Alberta have bus service. And Saskatchewan, which had a somewhat socialist government for many years, had its own provincially run bus service, Saskatchewan Transportation Service. In 2017, the Conservative government of Canada shut that down. And so again, dozens of towns lost their last transportation. And the issue of rural transportation, or the lack of rural transportation throughout Canada and the United States. And I think it's not just Canada and the United States. There's places like rural northern England, Northumberland and Cumberland are losing their bus services. Rural France is part of the anger of the yellow vests or the yellow jackets that you've probably seen the protests of was the loss of services to rural and small town France, as the government under Macron has cut budgets, making more effort to preserve social services, government services for the urban areas than for the rural areas. And so these communities have lost over the past decades, they've lost civil institutions, schools have been consolidated, the students may now be bused to a town 20 miles away to a consolidated thing. The post office may survive. Every now and then there's talk of cutting up to a third to a half of the rural post offices. A lot of towns don't have any emergency services, law enforcement, fire, or ambulances. Those have been reduced. And retail, grocery stores, hardware, gasoline, getting fuel for your vehicle are disappearing. And medical services. Some people now live 50, 60 miles from a doctor or a dentist or a veterinarian. And so this loss of transportation is part of a much larger issue for rural. And this public transportation problem even goes to school buses. School buses are have been part of, it is public transportation. It's limited to school as children, but they're very extensive networks. And in an article by the political columnist for the United States in The Economist magazine, he wrote about Fort Wayne, Indiana, that's talking about cutting their school bus system. And he says that it's more that this is reflects a larger issue. He wrote, These bus cuts were more than a local drama. Look closely, and Fort Wayne's woes point to a larger debate about how to pay for and supply public services. And he concludes with, Fort Wayne's bus crisis is surely fixable. Indiana passed rigid tax cuts without pondering the trade-offs that might follow. The school district is wedded to a business model that involves owning hundreds of its yellow buses. America used to excel at finding practical solutions to such puzzles. Not anymore. So what about the loss of passenger trains. What about the loss? Obviously, the range of opinions to people who are directly affected when that daily train isn't stopping anymore, providing service to for 10 miles or 1,000 miles. But obviously, there's the range of views. Here are two quotes from a man named Doug Young. He was transport minister for Canada in the government of Jean Chrétien. This was in the mid-90s under the Liberal government. Liberal in Canada means center-right. Trudeau is in the Liberal Party. And he was transport minister, but he had no interest. Most transport cabinet members who are in charge of transportation are just waiting for a real cabinet post to open up. They can actually have a serious job like treasury or state or something like that. So one of his quotes is, the national dream of iron horses, steel rails, and steam is dead. Now, steam had been dead for a long time, but and then he wrote of VIA, the government-run passenger trains. He said, they don't get my heart going pity-pat. So the people who wanted Canada's passenger trains back then didn't have a lot of hope, thinking that the government was going to care. On the other end, you have the rail enthusiasts who rode trains, who photographed them, and more. This is a caption from a picture book of railroads in Idaho, Washington, Oregon area, and it's a picture of a classic steam locomotive pulling a short passenger train into Lewiston, Idaho. And here is the cry of the heart that followed the details. Such scenes were once commonplace before the incursion of an age of psychopathic confusion, completely devoid of aesthetics, destroyed the beauty that once was. He did not take it well. So what would it take? You know, you've probably thought it, you've probably heard people say, I wish we in America, maybe not Montana, we had a rail passenger system like when I went to Czechoslovakia or when I was in Korea or when I went to China or I did that trip to the Arctic Circle in Norway. I wish we had that. What would it take for us to get that here? And one would be the political will for a government, and a government would only do that if there was a popular will where people said, we'll pay more tax if it goes to a passenger system. So that's one aspect. Another would probably be if gas prices tripled. That might, at least for a fair time. And the other thing that would help is if we had as many people in Montana as Germany, which is slightly smaller in area in Montana, had. And that's 83 million. If 83 million people lived in Montana, we would have a great transportation system. So you take Norway. Norway is almost exactly the same area as Montana, 148,000 square miles. Norway has 5.5 million people, which is about five times our population. Gas in Norway costs the equivalent of $7 a gallon. But I think more than that, Norwegians have a very different view of what government is for. In terms of social services, beyond defending the realm, beyond enforcing the law. So I think there's so much that has to be changed. I want to finish with three stories. We'll go back to better times. I assume a large number of you used to watch Chet Huntley on the news. For you young ones in the front, Chet Huntley was co-anchor for NBC, one of the, back when there were just three networks, and he hosted the news with David Brinkley. And Chet Huntley, his father was a telegrapher for the Great Northern, for the Northern Pacific Railway. He was born in the railway station. Those small railway stations had living quarters at Cardwell, which is just a little bit, there's a little community there. It's a little bit east of Whitehall along the Jefferson River. But his father was a telegrapher. On weekends when there was less traffic on the line, he could listen in on the news that was traveling on the thing, and he could follow, for instance, games. And if there was a major World Series, a prize fight, he could follow that. And this is how Chet Huntley wrote about his first broadcast experience. "My first experience in mass communications came as a result of Dad's trade as a telegrapher. On the days of a World Series game, if it was Saturday or Sunday, Dad would write down the play-by-play reports as they came over the wire. A cluster of people would gather in the waiting room of the station, and I would bellow through the ticket window the play-by-play action of the game." Express. Lots of things were carried by express. Valuables, money. That's why people robbed trains, because that's where the money was. Coffins traveled by express. Cans of milk going to a local creamery. One of the things that traveled by express was laundry. College students would send their laundry home to their parents by railway express, and then they would be sent back. And larger things, hotels would send large containers of laundry, large canvas hampers, put them on express cars and shipped into a commercial laundry. So a hotel in Shelby might send all its laundry to a big commercial laundry in Great Falls. So here's a quote from a novel set in Iowa in the early 1900s about a young man who sends his laundry home. And then his mother does the laundry and sends it back. And so, that the battered laundry case had been going back and forth between town and college until all the baggage men knew it by sight. Mrs. Ferguson never sent it back without tucked-in presents of cake and nuts and fried chicken, carefully done in her funny little amateur packages so that Carl's clean shirts wouldn't smell of food. And riding a train, some people probably were pretty oblivious, but some paid attention. So this is a passage from Eudora Welty, is one of the great Southern writers, was one of the great Southern writers of the 20th century. She grew up in Jackson, Mississippi. Her father was an insurance executive in Jackson, and he traveled a lot as part of his job. And so she rode with him sometimes. So she writes in a memoir about riding the train with her father. And he wasn't a railroader, he's an insurance man, but the attention he paid. "I had a window seat. Beside me, my dad checked the progress of our train by moving his finger down the timetable and springing open his pocket watch. He explained to me what the position of the arms of the semaphore, signals with arms that went up and down, before we were to pass through a switch, and he would watch the signal lights change. Along the track, the mileposts could be read. He read them. Right on time by Daddy's watch, the next town sprang into view and just as quickly was gone. Side by side and separately, we each lost ourselves in the experience of not missing anything, of seeing everything, of knowing each time what the blows of the whistle meant." And then she writes about, "After dinner in the dining car, they went to the back platform of the observation car. My father and I walked back to the open-air observation platform at the end of the train and sat on the folding chairs placed at the railing. We watched the sparks we made fly behind us into the night. Fast as our speed was, it gave us time enough to see the rose-red cinders turn to ash, each one, and disappear from sight." Departures and arrivals. Many, many young people left for college, for military service, for a job from the train station, on a train, with family watching. This is Hal Borland, who in the 50s, 60s, 70s was a well-known nature writer, wrote a lot about animals. He grew up in a small town, Flagler, Colorado, on the high plains of northeastern Colorado, on the Rock Island mainline to Colorado Springs in Denver. And he's taking the train, he's finished high school, and he's heading off to the rest of his life. I stood in the vestibule for a last look, first to the north at Flagler slipping past, then to the south, out to the old flats that had been the frontier, and were now just the high plains, where a new breed of men were plowing the grass and fencing the wind, or trying to, and making memories of yesterday the legends of tomorrow. Then the porter took my suitcase and led me to my seat. The locomotive far up there ahead whistled a long screaming blast for the crossing a mile east of town. Then we flashed past the old tattered cottonwood that was the only reminder of the store and post office called Bowserville. On towards Siebert, Stratton, Burlington, Goodland, east, toward tomorrow, whatever and wherever it might be. And I want to finish with a return. This is F. Scott Fitzgerald. It's from the almost at the end of The Great Gatsby. And the narrator is talking. This is an elite class. His narrator is talking about returning home from a prep school in the East to his home in Minnesota. And I assume this experience is very much like what Scott Fitzgerald experienced in the same situation. Christmas time, and the story starts in Chicago at the Union Station. They're riding on the Milwaukee Road, which of course was built and extended through Montana as well. So at last, the murky in Chicago Union Station. At last, the murky yellow cars of the Chicago, Milwaukee, and St. Paul Railway looking cheerful as Christmas itself on the tracks beside the gate. When we pulled out into the winter night and the real snow, our snow, began to stretch out beside us and twinkle against the windows, and the dim lights of small Wisconsin stations moved by a sharp wild brace suddenly into the air. We were unutterably aware of our identity with this country for one strange hour before we melted indistinguishably into it again. That's my Middle West, not the wheat or the prairies or the lost Swede towns, but the thrilling returning trains of my youth and the street lamps and sleigh bells in the frosty dark and the shadows of holly wreaths thrown by lighted windows on the snow.